The first one is Vetta versus Corrigan. The second is the Harmony Ditch Company versus the Julesburg Irrigation District. We are privileged today to have Senior Judge Sandra Rothenberg sitting with us on the division. I assume the council are familiar with our rules. I would remind council and anybody in the audience to turn off your cell phones or at least put them on mute or vibrate so that they don't interrupt the arguments today. We have issued an order in the first case concerning the length of oral argument, essentially dividing the argument into three sections. I assume council are familiar with the terms of that order. So we are going to have, or start with, 15 minutes per side on the first issue, 3 minutes per side on the second, and 7 minutes per side on the third. Unless there are any questions, we'll proceed with Vetta versus Corrigan. Council.
Thank you. To begin with, I'd like to reserve half of my time for this first compartment of the argument.
We'll see how it goes.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Benjamin Sachs. I represent the plaintiff's appellants and cross-appellees, Krista Vetta, through her legal representative, Janine Vetta. And at this point, I'd like to point out that Krista Vetta and Janine Vetta are present today for this oral argument, along with our co-counsel in the trial court. This argument relates to the first compartment of this argument, pertaining to the issues of whether the future economic damages ought to be paid in monthly installments stretching out to the year 2030 and beyond, assuming that Krista Vetta lives so long, or is to be paid in a lump sum as previously requested by Krista Vetta's court-appointed legal representative, Janine Vetta. This also includes the impact of certain legislation that was enacted in 2007 on this case, which specifically relates to pending actions, civil actions that are pending at the time that the legislation takes effect, which was August 3rd of 2007. And also, it concerns the decision of the trial court to cap the amount of future economic damages as they relate to lost earnings in the future for Krista Vetta, generally once she would attain the date of majority up until age 65. Now, in this particular case, Krista Vetta prevailed in a jury trial on her claims of medical malpractice against the defendants, Dr. Corrigan and Colorado Springs Health Partners. So she does appeal the amount of the judgment in her favor against Dr. Corrigan and his professional corporation. We are asserting error in the trial court's reduction of the amount of economic damages awarded by the jury for future lost earnings. According to the jury verdict form, that amount was $970,000 and was based on substantial economic evidence, expert evidence that was submitted at trial, as well as some information that was submitted to the trial court post-trial as part of the proceedings to determine whether and to what extent the cap should apply in this case, the HCAA cap. In deciding to cap the $970,000 award for future economic damages, particularly future lost earnings, the court made this finding. The court said there's no need to compensate her for loss of future income when her daily living expenses are already included in the award for future life care, medical, and other health care expenses. Because Krista has no need to generate income to meet her living expenses, there's no need to compensate her for the loss of future income. Well, we would submit to the court that this finding is not supported by the record and is clearly erroneous and contrary to the evidence that was presented to the trial court, in the trial court, both before the jury's verdict and afterwards, prior to the court imposing this cap. The court simply missed the point. The point is that the award for her medical expenses, for Krista's future medical expenses and her future healthcare expenses simply cover a portion of the needs that she will have as she grows older. But it does not compensate and cannot compensate for her other daily and ongoing living expenses, particularly for housing, for food, for shelter, for clothing. And the court simply got it wrong.
Counsel, let me ask you this. You just used the term medical and health care costs is what you awarded in the future damages. But it was also phrased in terms of life care, and it spoke in terms of feeding supplements and feeding tubes. Why is it an abuse of discretion to say that it was more than simply health and medical? It was life care, the cost of retrofitting a home, the cost of providing feeding supplements and tubes. Why is that an abuse of discretion, which is our standard review?
Well, you're actually asking several questions. We would submit that you're reviewing this finding for clear error, so it's not simply an abuse of discretion.
Although
I would agree that it's an abuse of discretion when the court makes clear error based without record support. But putting that aside, the components of the life care plan were copiously described in the testimony of Helen Woodard and as well as Dr. Pat Pacey. And the components of it were specified, and those are definitely related to the health needs and to the living needs of someone with the type of global developmental delays and disabilities, severe disabilities that Krista Vetteta has. No part of it, though, is to cover ordinary necessities of life, such as food, shelter. Those simply were not part of the life care plan, nor were they ever intended to be.
Was it the testimony that she would be in a feeding tube for the rest of her life and that it would provide for the bags of feeding supplements? Are there any ordinary costs of food that are not covered that she will need to have?
Well, okay, you're focusing on the elements of food. I think that you're referring to certain supplements that were required in order to supplement her diet because she is not capable of chewing and eating and digesting normally. But first of all, it would be a mistake to focus just simply on the food issue without also considering the other common necessities of life, Your Honor. Things like a place to live. The ordinary necessities of life are the very things that ordinary people are able to support and maintain through their earnings and income. And that was precisely the kind of compensation that the jury intended to provide Krista Vetteta. There may be some validity that her ordinary food expenses might be diminished because of the circumstances you described, but that doesn't take away from her other basic necessities. They're not even extraordinary needs. Many of the needs that are addressed in the life care plan are extraordinary health care needs, but we're talking about basic needs that everyone has after they achieve the age of majority. So we're talking about supporting Krista Vetteta well beyond the year 2030, or at least up to 2030 and beyond, and how to accomplish that. And this is the financial responsibility properly of the defendants who caused Krista Vetteta's severe disabilities and impairments. So I hope that answers your question. I think I should move on to another aspect, and that is that the court also determined specifically that it was appropriate to cap the future economic damages for lost earnings because Krista does not have, as a child of tender years, nor could she have, a documented history of earnings. And Therefore, that provided a basis. Now, the court was actually referring to a list of factors that were identified in the Wallbank case, which is really the only other case that deals with application of the cap with respect to a child of tender years who suffers an injury before reaching majority and before having any employment history. And I just want to point out that the use of that criterion to refuse payment to Krista Vitetta, we're contending, was a violation of equal protection, and that's as applied to her, because there's no way that a child who is injured under the circumstances that she is can ever satisfy trial court as to that criteria, can never establish a documented history of earnings. And the court didn't determine that there was insufficient evidence of future economic damages in that area. That was never part of the court's determination. The court was simply saying that because we don't have a record showing documented earnings history, that is a sufficient basis for concluding that there isn't good cause to exceed the cap. So
Mr. Sachs, for equal protection purposes in this context, how do you define the class of similarly situated individuals?
The class are children of tender years who are the victims of established, proven medical negligence and who are seeking and who are awarded future economic damages for lost earnings.
Well, if that's the class, they're all treated the same. So where's the equal protection problem?
Well, they're treated disparately, Your Honor, is our contention, because people who are victims of medical negligence who are fortunate enough to have a documented history of earnings are not excluded per se from recovery of future economic damages in this category.
So that's a different class, though. You define the class as children of tender years who don't have that earnings history. Well, if that's the class, they're all treated the same. They may be treated differently than another class of otherwise similarly situated individuals.
They're treated differently when the trial court uses that criteria. And there are other cases in which the trial court has recognized and decided that that is not the criterion to be applied. So what I'd like to do is to reserve my remaining time.
You don't want to address the lump sum issue?
I feel I need to retain some time. Briefly, the lump sum issue, it's a question of interpretation. We submit that the court has jurisdiction and it has a duty to apply the law that is applicable, and that this statute clearly defines the scope of applicability. It's a remedial and a procedural statute, and it covers all actions that are pending. There's case law that we cited in the brief that indicates that pending isn't simply limited to actions that, you know, that culminate in a final judgment and then it's no longer pending. It continues when there are appeals. So
I have a question along those lines. Is any statute that changes the amount that may be recovered through the damages award, is that remedial in your view, or is that substantive?
Well, this particular statute was intended to be remedial. The jury had to determine the present discount value of the future economic damages, and that was determined in the special verdict form that it returned. At that point, the court, you know, the law provided an option for people like Krista Vitetta and her legal representative. I think it's very important to understand that there's a unique feature of this. I'll just take some additional time. The declared legislative purposes of this make it absolutely clear that this was designed to implement the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990 by making available to qualified people with disabilities the full and immediate benefit of their judgments. So this was actually implementing a law that far predated the accrual of this claim. So all it did simply was it allowed the option of a lump sum payment under specified circumstances. We would submit it as procedural and remedial and not substantive for purposes of determining whether it is impermissibly retrospective. Thank you. I'll reserve the remaining part of my time.
May it please the court.
My name is David Yoon. My registration number is 23448. I will be arguing on behalf of defendants, appellees, cross appellants, Dr. Corrigan, and Colorado Springs Health Partners, PC. I want to first address the lump sum issue. It is concerning the issue of applicability of the 2007 amendment to the periodic payment statute. Before I get to the legal arguments, it's important to keep in mind several factual background. The trial took place and the jury reached a verdict in June of 2006. On November 3, 2006, the trial court ordered that Krista Viteta's future damages have to be paid periodically under the then existing law, CRS 1364-205. After plaintiffs filed several unsuccessful motions for reconsideration, the trial court entered final judgment ordering periodic payments on April 20th, 2007. At that time, at the time of the final judgment, it's undisputed that the statute did not allow the plaintiff to elect a lump sum payment. Unhappy with this judgment, plaintiffs and their counsel went to the legislature to change the periodic payment statute. Plaintiff's counsel, Natalie Brown, who is a part of their firm, testified, and Mrs. Viteta testified at legislative hearing, expressing their unhappiness with the existing law. After getting the law changed, plaintiffs, now on appeal for the first time, are arguing that this court should apply the statute retroactively to what I believe is undoing a final judgment entered on April 20th, 2007. Their attempt, we would submit, to change the rules after the fact is unfair, unjust, and shouldn't be allowed. Under Colorado law, there is a presumption that statutes will be applied prospectively, meaning that they have to apply to transactions and events after its effective date. Colorado law also frowns upon retroactive application of the statute. In order to overcome this presumption, there has to be a clear legislative intent to apply the statute retroactively. In this case, if you look at the legislation as a whole, the 2007 amendment, the legislative declaration, it says, it is in the best interest of the citizens of this state to ensure that each disabled individual who receives a judgment, using future tense, then the operative change in the statute is to allow a plaintiff's legal representative to make an election of a lump sum payment at the time the judgment is entered.
Counsel, let me ask you, you're talking about the preamble. Let's look directly at the language, sure. Though. The direct language we have to interpret is that the question, put it directly, is this a pending civil action right now?
I believe you have to look at the context of the legislative declaration as well as what the operative change is.
Before we get to the context, so let's start with the plain language. Is this a pending civil action?
I believe the wording is ambiguous as to whether it applies to this appeal. I believe the language, this act shall apply to civil actions pending on or after August 3.
So your argument has to be that this is not a pending civil action, doesn't it?
I believe there's a presumption of prospectivity, and I believe it's ambiguous whether it includes an appeal at this time. And as the court knows, the case law says that one of the best way to express a legislative intent to apply retroactively is to clearly say so in the legislation. In this case, the legislature could have clearly wrote one word if they wanted to have it apply retroactively, to say this act shall apply to civil action or appeals pending on or after August 3, 2007.
So you're saying a civil action and an appeal of a civil action are two different things?
I think it's not in the context, and I will describe it better, but in the context, it is not clear. And what I'm saying is, that's why I was going down the road of what the legislative declaration says, which is using present tense and which is the pole star of legislative intent. And then you have to look at what the operative change is. the operative change to the statute is allowing election. So the next question is, when can you make that election? As the court knows, in a medical malpractice case, the jury has to determine, make special findings on future damages. After the jury verdict is returned, then the court must make a interjudgment for periodic payments. And if the plaintiff doesn't want periodic payments, they have to make that election at that time.
And before the amendment, they had to make the election within 3 months, no more than 3 months after entry of the verdict, and that was repealed by this legislation.
Yes, but Your Honor, if you look at the entire statute, the provision, the first paragraph on 205 says, still contains the language, in order to determine what judgment is to be entered on a verdict requiring findings of special damages under this part two, the court shall proceed as follows. So then it says, subparagraph F then states that the plaintiff who meets the criteria set forth in this section one may elect to receive immediate payment. So I think when you take that into context, you still have to make the election at the time the trial court enters judgment.
Before the amendment, it was very clear that they would have been out of time because it had to be within 3 months of verdict. They consciously struck that language and now don't have an express timing requirement.
Yes, right? And I think there's a very good reason. If the court will look at subsection F, it requires financial counseling in making an informed decision. That takes time. It also allows...
That was a requirement, wasn't it?
That was in there. But it also requires legal representative to be appointed and to make the election. That also takes time. So within 3 months of the verdict, it's very difficult to achieve, as was in this case. If the court will see the procedural history, the verdict, it took 10 months from the date of verdict to the date of the final judgment. Why? Because there was a whole issue whether or not you should reduce the cap, you should apply the cap. The party has to file the briefs, and if before you make the election, I would submit that a legal representative will probably want to know, is it going to be, for example, $1 million judgment or $5 million judgment before making a decision as to whether or not they're going to elect periodic or lump sum payment. And I think that was more of a consistent with the entire structure of the statute. There is no provision. Once a judgment is entered for periodic payment, there is no provision in the Health Care Availability Act to allow a change in the election. It doesn't say that once an election occurs, you could change an election or you can make an election at any time. If you look at the structure of it, the election has to occur when the order awarding periodic payments occur.
Let me ask you this. Is there any tension, would you say, between your first argument that this was not written clearly enough to apply to this case and your last argument that it was the only purpose of this legislation was special legislation meant to apply to the Petettas? Is there any tension between those two arguments, do you think?
I think that I am making multiple different arguments, alternative arguments. So, sure, there's tension, but what I'm saying is that after a final judgment, you shouldn't be allowed to, just because you don't like the outcome of a case, go back to the legislature and say, I don't like the outcome, so we can legislatively change the judgment.
Why don't you address the constitutional retrospectivity argument?
Sure.
If you're talking about unfairness, because I think that's
sure. The retrospective, even if the court were to find that there was a clear intent to apply retroactively, the court still has to determine whether the statute is retrospective in this operation. And the court, as you know, says clearly, retrospective means taking away, impairing vested rights acquired under existing law or creating a new obligation or imposing a new duty. While I agree with plaintiff's counsel that procedural and remedial changes in the law generally are constitutional, the changes do become unconstitutionally retrospective when they are applied to a final judgment entered by the trial court. In this case, in the Kirk case that we cited, illustrates that. The Supreme Court said it is within the power of the legislature to take away rights which have been, I'm sorry, it is not within the power of the legislature to take away rights which have been vested by a judgment. Legislation may act on subsequent proceedings, may abate actions pending, but when those actions have passed into judgment. The power of the legislature to disturb the rights created thereby ceases.
Mr. Nguyen, doesn't that limitation apply once we have a final judgment, meaning a final judgment that's been all the way through the appeal process?
I think in that case, they were talking about the entry of judgment by the trial court. And I would submit that you do have, well, first of all, appellate courts, Rule 1 of the Colorado Appellate Rule says that you need a final judgment before you can appeal. Secondarily, I think an appellate court is reviewing the record to make sure there's no error with respect to that judgment. And they can't receive new evidence, they can't make new findings of fact, they can't do anything that the trial court can do. What they're doing is reviewing the case for whether or not there was error with respect to the judgment based on the law existing at that time. What I'm saying is, unless the court reverses the judgment and remands for a new trial, then it would be pending. But if you're just reviewing it, I think that the party has a vested interest. And one example, an appeal does not stay in execution of judgment. An appeal party can still execute on a judgment unless the other party pulls a supersedious bond and asks for a stay. Therefore, I believe there's a vested interest in that judgment.
All right, so let me see if I understand your argument correctly. Are you conceding then that the change here may be remedial, but notwithstanding that, because it occurred after what you call the final judgment, it impaired a vested right?
Yes, and it's no different than, let's say, oh, we also made payments for, by the way, 2 years and 4 months into the court registry based on the final order.
And the plaintiffs don't want them.
But the court entered an order that it is a satisfaction and they can withdraw at any time. But it's no different than, for example, if a homeowner who enters into a contract to make a monthly payment on a mortgage. And just as a homeowner has a vested interest under a contract to make monthly payments, defendants have a vested interest in this final judgment.
Let me ask you this, if I could, and home in on the vested interest part of your argument. It was about a $4.1 million judgment. I understand part of that was attorney's fees. It was payable immediately, and you object to that. But just putting that aside, a $4.1 million judgment, could the court have required you to pay that $4.1 million immediately towards an annuity and said, we want you to purchase an annuity payable over time, but pay the full $4.1 million to purchase that?
The court has discretion because there are six different ways of funding the periodic payments. And one of the ways we fund it is expressly allowed under the statute, which is by a liability insurer, and which includes any qualified liability insurer is anybody who's licensed in the state of the Colorado. And I just want to point out, their annuity, they wanted to have it funded by American General, which was an AIG company. Copic is one of the largest, or is the largest insurer of Colorado physicians.
No, I understand that, but it would have been within the court's discretion, not whether it was an abuse of discretion to require Copic to do it or allow you to use Copic, but the court could have said, pay $4.1 million right now and purchase an annuity of this form so it's payable to Christopher Ted and her parents over 25 years. The court could have done that.
The judge could have done it, but he didn't. This court.
Understood. But yep. under existing law, prior to this new 07 change, the court could have said, pay $4.1 million right now. So the effect on you would have been the same as under the election part of the new law. Is that right?
I believe that the court had the discretion to do it, but it did not. And this court, I believe it's one of the items, the method that the court chose is within it's the court's discretion.
And I can accept that fully. I'm just saying in terms of a vested right, you did not have a vested right to avoid having to pay $4.1 million even under the prior 07 law. It was not a vested right. You could appeal to the court's discretion, but the court could have said, no, pay the $4.1 million, purchase an annuity on her behalf.
Right? I understand now the court's, yes, at that time. But what happens was the court had entered final judgment and said you can pay it periodically. And what I'm saying is we had a vested right at that time. Once the court transforms it to a judgment, it is a vested right.
All right, so the right vested at the time of the judge, not at the time of the verdict, you didn't have any vested right, but when the court exercised its discretion to allow you to use the Kulpik alternative, then that right vested is your argument.
Yes, and it's no different than if the court, in the middle of the lawsuit, let's say in discovery, if there's a new legislation passed and says periodic payment has to apply, then the court legislation has the authority to do that. But once you have a judgment, it's a completely different thing.
Thank you.
Your time is up, counsel. Thank you. I believe that Mr. Sachs, you have a minute and 15 seconds left for rebuttal.
Opposing counsel points out that it's ambiguous as to the intent of the legislature when it used this terminology that's applicable to civil actions that were pending when the statute took effect. It's not ambiguous. This usage is common among legislatures, and we cited cases in the brief, including the McKenzie case, that until you have a final non-appealable judgment, the action is still pending. So there's no ambiguity. And to the extent that there is ambiguity, the legislative history is replete with references. As counsel indicated, plaintiff's counsel as well as Janine Vitetta testified on this legislation. The sponsors of this legislation indicated their desire that this should apply in her case as well as other cases just like it. Judge Connolly, you mentioned that you thought it might be significant that as part of this amendatory legislation, the legislature took out any time limit. Well, we would submit that, of course, it is significant. It has to be. You know, you can't assume that the legislature did it for no reason at all, and it did it in recognition of the fact that this application can be made at any time.
Mr. Sachs, your time is up.
Thank you.
We're going to proceed to phase two of the argument this afternoon, in which the parties have 3 minutes per side to discuss the court's reduction of the medical expense award. And in particular, as the order indicates, Mr. Sachs, we would like you to address the issue of whether this was preserved in the trial court, and specifically how and where. And whether it's moot given the $1 million cap.
All right. Briefly, because there's very limited time.
3 minutes.
The Supreme Court recently, as the court's probably aware.
Mr. Sachs, could you wait just a second? They're having trouble with the clock. Okay, you may proceed.
Okay. The court's interested in the Tucker case, which was recently decided by a division of this court. As the court is probably also aware, the Supreme Court recently granted cert to review the court of the division's decision in the Tucker case. Basically, the Tucker case was dealing with the so-called contract exception of the collateral source rule, and the court held that disallowed amounts fall under the contract exception and can't be set off. In this particular case, the Tucker case was not a medical malpractice action, of course, and this case is, and there are certain salient differences, one of which is that past medical expenses are, of course, subsumed within a $1 million cap, and as a result, the cap had consequences for the past medical expenses award. But for the cap, our contention was simply that the plaintiff would have recovered and should have recovered the full unmitigated amount of medical expenses billed plus pre-judgment interest and post-judgment interest on that principal amount. But because of the cap and its application, basically that amount was crammed down, and it was also reduced, of course, because of pro rata liability. So what we have is an award by a jury recognizing the past medical expenses that were billed that was significantly crammed down and reduced. Yet, in this case, The contention of Fortis is that the trial court was perfectly correct in awarding it the full unmitigated amount of the medical expenses it actually paid.
Well, that may go to issue number three in the kind of line,
right.
But I'm still confused about how this is not moot. And you're seeking, this is an argument as pertaining to defendants. It seems to me it's moot. Isn't it moot?
Mootness isn't exactly the terminology.
Why does it matter?
It doesn't matter for purposes of Dr. Corrigan and CSHP. It matters plenty as to the next, what we're going
okay,
to discuss.
So I think it doesn't matter as to the way it was raised in the briefs.
Well, it was raised in conjunction with anti-subrogation and common fund.
It was raised as against the defendant.
Mr. Sachs, we're not done with this issue. I would like you to specifically address where this was raised below. Where did you raise this argument below?
Where did we raise
the... Did you raise it below? And if not, why should we even entertain?
Well, specifically, we raised a host of issues related to Fortis's claim based on its asserted lien. And, you know, because this issue, and I apologize for any confusion, but this issue really relates to the subrogation issues. It was raised in conjunction with those issues, but it doesn't relate to the other cross appellants, or, you know, Corrigan and CSHP. But it does relate to issues on our appeal as to the trial court's orders relating to Fortis and their cross appeal relating to us.
Thank you.
Your Honor, if it doesn't apply to the defendants, Dr. Corrigan and Colorado Springs Health Partners, I have no comment. He asked to restore the judgment, and that's why I filed the motion to strike.
I can understand why you thought it applied to you, but I think given the concession, I think it doesn't.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, well now we'll move on to phase three, where each side gets 7 minutes to, not each side, but the plaintiffs and the intervener, Fortis, gets 7 minutes to talk about the subrogation issue.
The last portion of this trifurcated argument relates to Fortis. Fortis was an intervener, and it intervened in this action, actually citing as part of the basis for its intervention the common fund doctrine, interestingly enough, as a reason for intervening and asserting claims against the defendants for the past medical expenses that it had paid as a group insurer, or as an insurer for the Vitetta family, to various medical providers. And the way the trial court addressed the issue of past medical expenses, as is apparent from the special verdict form, was to put a line item amount for the amount of past medical expenses billed, and then to take up the issue later on as to whether and to what extent that should be reduced. So the jury essentially agreed with that amount of past medical expenses and awarded it. The court then reduced, because of pro rata liability, on account there were designated non-parties, including Penrose, and so they reduced on account of pro rata liability. And then there were several proceedings in the trial court in which the intervener, thought to be a plaintiff intervener, voluntarily dismissed with prejudice all of its claims against the defendants. And around the same time, the plaintiff intervener also entered into an agreement where Dr. Riesch would agree not to seek any costs against the intervener, against Fortis, and essentially, all of the claims between the intervener and Fortis were disposed of in that manner. Now, that didn't end the request. Fortis specifically requested that the plaintiff then be ordered to pay the full amount of its asserted lien. And that's what raised the multiple issues and issues that were raised frequently in the trial court. And our first issue has to do with the application of the anti-subrogation rule. Fortis maintains that there are three different bases for its lien claim. One is contract, one is statute, and one is a common law equitable subrogation doctrine. And our contention is that the sole basis for Fortis to proceed in this case, and it chose to do so correctly, we're not criticizing how they initially started, was to assert a claim and seek a judgment against the defendants for the amount of its subrogated interest pursuant to the Health Care Availability Act, not to assert a claim based on contract or equitable grounds against the plaintiff. Our contention on appeal is that that is precluded under this court's longstanding anti-subrogation rule, which bars an insurance company or health insurer like Fortis from seeking a remedy against its own insurer. But that's not all. You know, our other primary contention in this case had to do with the amount. And we submitted to the trial court that the amount should be reduced. And this relates to what I just said before while I was standing here. And that is that Krista Vitetta saw the verdict of the jury substantially reduced and cut and capped and was greatly diminished as a result of the application of the cap. Now, what this meant was that although the jury determined that it was fair and just that she receive a fully compensatory award for her past medical expenses, in reality, that, along with other damages that were found to be fair and just by the jury, were crammed down to...
This, but for the cap, if you recovered $274,000 that the Vitettas were not out of pocket because Ford has paid that, is that right?
Say again?
You recovered from the jury... as plaintiffs, $274,000 roughly.
Well, we recovered from the jury the higher amount, the medical expenses bill.
Among that was a special determination of $274,000 of out-of-pocket monies that the plaintiffs had reimbursed. They did not directly incur.
The jury awarded $345,000.
And that was by agreement, I think, reduced to right. $274,000.
Well, it wasn't by agreement. It was then reduced by the court. It was crammed down. Because of the court's essentially its determination on what you would call the Tucker issue, but then it was further reduced because it was reduced to $1 million.
$345 or $274 Okay. That was money that was not incurred by the Vitettas, but they were awarded by the jury. That was money that Fortis paid on their behalf.
Yes.
But for the statutory caps, is there any reason that Fortis would not be entitled to recover that money out of the verdict?
Yes, the common fund doctrine.
And explain that doctrine to me.
The common fund doctrine is based on equity. It's grounded in equity, and it's based on the notion that it would cause unjust enrichment to a subrogated interest for them not to actively participate, but then to receive 100% of their asserted lien claim.
And what's the first time and in what way did you raise that common fund argument in the trial court?
That was
pretty oblique. It was not really, how was it raised?
Well, actually it was raised, I'm trying to recall whether it was, I know it was.
Didn't you just say it was raised by Fortis?
Well, it was initially raised by Fortis as part of the basis for their intervention, but it was raised in response to Fortis's post-trial motion for entry of judgment for the full amount. So there was an extensive discussion of that it's necessary to prevent unjust enrichment to take into account the fact that Fortis was a passive beneficiary and not an active participant, and therefore that should be considered by the trial court in determining what amount, if any, to award to Fortis.
And you as plaintiff's counsel argued Fortis should be limited by the common fund doctrine? I'm having trouble finding where you argued that specifically to the...
Yes, and actually in the response, there's a section specifically titled Inequity, Fortis's recovery should be prorated and reduced. Plaintiffs respectfully ask that this court use its discretion and reduce the amount of the judgment to be entered on behalf of Fortis for the payment of past medical bills because the judgments entered for Krista Vitetta and Fortis respectively must be based in equity. And it goes on to address concepts of unjust enrichment.
Did you use the phrase common fund?
No, it did not intone the magic words, common fund doctrine. But,
and it appealed to the court's discretion, so this would be an abuse of discretion standard review?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Sachs.
Well, except for one thing. I promise, 10 seconds. The court determined that it didn't have the discretion to reduce. Our interpretation of this order is that the court determined that it just didn't have the ability to do that. So it never reached the issue of whether it should.
Thank you, Mr. Sachs.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Diane Smith, registration 14340, appearing on behalf of Fortis. Judge Connolly, I'd like to address your questions first. And the answer to where did the plaintiff raise the common fund doctrine in the trial court is they didn't. When we moved to intervene, the plaintiffs did not respond, they did not answer, they did not object. The defendants objected, and in the course of the briefing on that issue, Fortis, in fact, raised the common fund doctrine. Now, in that process, before the judge decided the intervention issue, plaintiffs never joined in that briefing, and they never adopted that argument as one of their own. When we were in the process of the post-trial awards, again, plaintiffs never raised the common fund issue. It was only when we got to this court, and you get to their brief, that they began arguing common fund. In the trial court, what they argued it for or as was unjust enrichment. If they wanted to make an unjust enrichment claim, well, then they needed to answer, or they needed to assert a cross claim or a counterclaim in the course of responding to the petition and intervention. Otherwise, that issue was waived. It was simply not preserved. And with respect to the arguments about passive beneficiary versus active participant, that's also relatively easy to answer under the reasoning of the Osborne case. In fact, Fortis was extremely active in this case. We filed our notice of subrogation when we received the notice that it was involved in the case. We intervened and asserted multiple claims for relief. We made 26A1 fact disclosures and 26A2 expert disclosures. We attended multiple depositions, both in and out of state, including those of the experts of both plaintiff and defendant. We participated in the trial preparation that included the preparation of exhibit and witness lists and the trial management order. We submitted an extensive trial brief related to the subrogation issues. Mr. Van Doren, who was trial counsel in this case, attended every single day of the four-week trial and participated in the voir dire. But for a late stipulation during the trial, he also would have been questioning witnesses, but never got to that point. The stipulation as to the $345,000 related to the past medical expenses was arrived at with the aid of Mr. Van Doren, who provided all of the billings that led up to the entry of that stipulation. And then finally, obviously, filed numerous post-trial motions that led specifically to the entry of judgments in favor of Fortis, that including the 45% against the settling defendant amounts and the 55% against the judgment related to Dr. Corrigan and his employer. Now, I'd like to back up to the subrogation issues, which is where we started. First of all, you have to look at the insuring agreement in this context. The contract between Fortis and the Vitettas contained two provisions that are relevant in this case. And yes, in fact, they were asserted below, and you'll find those in the intervention petition. One is the right of subrogation, and that right attaches to payments received by settlement, judgment, or otherwise, but is limited to the amounts of benefits that we have paid. In other words, money flowing from the third parties into the hands of the plaintiffs through settlement, judgment, or otherwise, the right of subrogation attaches to those funds. The second provision of the contract is for reimbursement, and the contract provides, if benefits are paid under this plan, and you recover against any person by settlement, judgment, or otherwise, we have a right to recover from you an amount equal to the amount that we have paid. And with respect to whether it's $345,000 or $247,000, Fortis doesn't have a dog in that fight. We only are in claiming an entitlement to the amounts that we have paid, the $247,000. Now, with respect to the awards that were entered, number one, the October award is perfectly consistent with the law regarding the anti-subrogation rules. We have a lien statute that preserves the right to recover a subrogated amount. That's in the Health Care Availability Act. And there was no requirement for payment until the plaintiffs were paid and the funds coming from a third party could then be attached. With respect to the second award, which they have questioned in this case, that against the settlement funds, I would submit that this court does not have jurisdiction over that claim because they failed to file a proper notice of appeal as to that.
And your cross appeal about the unsealing of records would be moot if we agreed with the other parts?
Yes, Your Honor. It would be moot if the two orders allowing the awards to Fortis are affirmed, then our cross appeal would be moot. If it isn't moot, then the only way for us to address the issues raised by the Vitettas, reduce the judgment in favor of Fortis, would be for the trial court to have an understanding as to the entire amount they have received, not simply by judgment, but also by settlement. We know they got at least $5.5 million. That's the verdict amount, the interest, and the cost thereafter. There is some other amount which was subject to the probate award, and we think the trial court needs to know that amount in order to make a decision about reduction. Now, finally, it's important to look at the anti-subrogation rule for another reason. There is a tension here. One is that there is case law upholding the right of subrogation when you have medical payment subrogation clauses. The De Herrera case specifically recognized that clauses of that nature are enforceable. There's an important public policy reason for that, to which this court alluded earlier. It protects the rights of insurance companies or payors to recover money that the plaintiff didn't, in the first instance, pay out. It's to prevent windfalls in that context when one party has paid and the other has not. Against that, you have to balance the policies of the anti-subrogation rule. But if you look at that, the whole purpose of the subrogation rule is to prevent insurance companies from selling what's essentially an illusory coverage. In this case, as you previously indicated, there was coverage for the medical benefits that Ms. Vitetta needed as a result of her injuries, monies that the Vitetta family did not have to pay, but they got immediately pursuant to their insurance contract, which then Fortis had a right under the Health Care Availability Act to recover. I would submit to this court that the only proper action in this case based upon the law is to affirm the trial court's two rulings awarding reimbursement and subrogation to Fortis.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I believe that concludes the argument in this case. We thank counsel for your arguments and your time. The case will stand submitted and we will issue an opinion in due course.
Is that a regular argument? 15 and 15?
The next one is
All right, counsel, for the second case, Harmony Ditch Company versus Julesburg Irrigation District, can go ahead and set up and we'll proceed with that case. Counsel ready? You may proceed.